shaking. Rule 1. Always test fire a new weapon, no matter how proficient you might think you are. And Rule 2. Listen to the poodle. I went into the house where Corky greeted me, still in that wonderfully high-pitched scream, and we sat for a time in a big chair, Corky in my lap, me petting him and telling him that even with me spending more than $1,000 on him, he had been a wonderful buy. And again he knew. He knew what he had done and what his job was, and with each day his work evolved more and more. From that day forward, for the rest of the summer, we were inseparable. I would awaken at 4 in the morning, have a bowl of oatmeal, and give Corky his breakfast of raw meat. I had learned years earlier that the best dog food in the world was plain raw hamburger, no matter the breed, and we would go to work. I bought a new shotgun, which I always kept at hand, and the Walmart in Wasilla started carrying an anti-bear spray that was very effective, which I carried in a holster on my belt. Corky sat at my side, no matter where I worked, watching the surrounding spruce forest, and if anything moved, anything, a branch, a leaf, a limb, he started the keening sound, and I would stop what I was doing and investigate where he looked, and always, always there was something. A breeze, a squirrel, a fox, a grouse with chicks, a wolf, a moose, another squirrel, dozens of squirrels, a marten, a porcupine, several bears, more moose, once a wolverine, always something. He was like an early warning radar, always on guard, always alert. And if that was all he did, watch the forest when I was outside, it would have been enough. With practice, I quickly came to believe him, to trust him and his judgment. But he expanded his duties constantly. At first he was a guard dog, all 8 pounds, well, 9 and finally 10 when the raw meat kicked in. And then he began to make judgment calls as well. A grouse would take a softer sound than, say, a bear. And in the end, a squirrel would be only a whimper, while a moose or bear would be an outright bark, with a grizzly bear bringing the loudest bark, slash, scream, slash, whine of all. I came to depend even more on his knowledge and judgment, to the point that he was no longer my dog, my pet, but we were equals. And finally, as it had been with Josh and the mayor, we were not equals any longer, but he was above me in some way, able to see what I could not, hear what I could not. We would start out in the morning and I would hesitate at the door, let him out first to look around the yard for a moment, pee on the porch post, declaim the day as useful and safe, and then we would move into it. And still it grew. I was sitting at the table one day, having a cup of tea with a friend, Corky sleeping in my lap. The friend had left something he wanted to show me out in his truck, and he suddenly stood to walk around me to the door to bring it in. As he moved behind me, Corky awakened, stood on my lap, bared his 2 lower and 1 upper right tooth, a god-awful grotesque look, as if trying to do an Elvis Presley impersonation, and uttered what, for Corky, was a very threatening growl. Considering that Corky knew this friend, loved this friend, had earlier been asleep in this friend's own lap, the growl was surprising, to say the least. "It's your back," he said. "He doesn't want anybody behind you." And that was it. A new criteria to his job. Watch my six, as fighter pilots would put it. Nobody could be behind me without a warning. Not even a friend. "Thank God he doesn't have opposing thumbs," my friend said. "He'd get a gun, and God knows how many people he'd shoot just for walking behind you." The thing is, he's not an angry or yappy dog. He loves people, greets them with all the tail wags possible, licks their faces. absolutely adores children. He's just a loving and sweet dog. But he's got these rules, his own rules for guarding me, handling me, taking care of me. We are friends. We love each other. He sleeps in bed with me in the crook of my knees, but I am more as well. I am the job. Two more bits of information on Corky. Studies have been done on mirrors and animals, and it has been decided that only primates understand the concept of reflection in a mirror. Even other monkeys don't realize that they're looking at themselves in the reflection. We have an old 1996 Ford dog truck, which we use for hauling sled dogs. The box in back makes it impossible to see out the back window. But there are large side rearview mirrors, and Corky watches in the mirrors. When somebody comes up from the rear to pass us, he growls. They're on our six. He reads the mirrors, and nobody but nobody gets on our six without a warning, because he is, and knows he is, after all, the Corkinator. One further note. The sled dogs came back from the glacier in late September, still before snow, and moved in and peed in their circles, and in a wonderful way changed the dynamic of everything. There was glad noise, songs, snarls, and joy, and Corky decided he did not need to patrol the yard from the windows in the house as much as he had. Also, the pandemonium of the kennel scared away the eagles, only for a short time, and then they came back with a vengeance, along with 30 ravens. More on this in later chapters. So we would let Corky out in the yard by the house without worrying about air attacks, except from owls, which usually hit only at night. Because of the clamor, he would stay away from the sled dogs. Or so we thought. And for a couple of weeks, it seemed to be working that way. Because there was no snow, we pulled a four-wheeler with three 16-dog teams, strengthening them and training leaders, Corky watching from the windows as we ripped out of the kennel and into the trail system. Everything seemed to have settled in. There was a bit of extra noise when the sled dogs saw me let Corky out for a few minutes to, I thought, mark the porch posts. I left him there on the front porch in the dark as I went in and started coffee and some bacon for sandwiches. And when I came back to the door, Corky would be sitting there waiting, would come into the house to sit on the windowsill, watch us harness, and leave. The perfect house dog. Then we got a new inch of snow, and I could see tracks, and I found that Corky had hidden issues. I thought he was peeing on and marking the porch. Dead wrong. His ego was much too substantial for such limited territory. His little poodle tracks, remember, he weighed between 8 and 10 pounds, and most of the sled dogs clocked in at 50 or so, trotted past the porch posts, out around the house, directly up to the lead dog position in the kennel. There were two female leaders and one male. And he claimed them, peeing on the edges of their circles, which lit them up, set them to lunging and snarling at him. He owned them. That's what he was saying with his actions. You're mine. Then, dividing the kennel into four more sections, he marked five more places, essentially claiming ownership and leadership over the entire kennel. All eight romping, stomping pounds of him. Grizzlies, sled dogs, people, it didn't matter. He owned them all. He simply had no fear. Then back to the house, touching up the porch post as he came to the door, up the steps to sit, waiting for me to let him in for breakfast. We feed pure meat to the sled dogs. Well, all dogs, as far as that goes. Cut up chunks of bloody beef heart. And the smell went out and out into the surrounding forest. And drawn by the smell, the eagles came back. Started trying to steal it from the sled dogs. Some of their passes and strikes came close to Corky, so we retired him to New Mexico, where I have a shack in the mountains. I am sitting there now, writing this, and Corky is with me. He is older now, his hearing dampened a bit, his eyes dimming a little. But yesterday I was sitting writing, and a flock of wild turkeys, I think about 20 of them, came up onto the back porch looking for scraps. And Corky hit the glass of the back door like a snarling banshee, shoulder hair up, three teeth bared in slavering spit Elvis grimace, and he scared them away in a showering storm of turkey poop and blown wing feathers. My six is still covered. Chapter 2. A very young soldier, a very old man, a mina bird named Betty, nuclear war, and Gretchen. 1959. It was difficult, almost impossible, to bridge the age-time gap between us. I was 18. So young, my brain had hardly started to function. In the Army, stationed at Fort Bliss, Texas, near El Paso, learning to kill my fellow man with various weapons, including missiles and nuclear warheads. Living in a state of perpetual confusion, mixed with a dosage of fear. We expected Russia to attack at any moment, and we found later that Russia felt the same way about us. I had, without any choice, been enrolled in the Army's nuclear warhead school and had been stunned to learn the truth about all-out nuclear war. To wit, nobody walks away, and it doesn't do any good to duck under your desk and hide, as we had been told by the media and in school. The man sitting across from me at an oilcloth-covered kitchen table was 83. He had lived in the desert his whole life. Indeed, what amounted to several lifetimes in many cultures. And he was so sun-blasted and deeply wrinkled that it was easy to imagine the wrinkles going all the way through his head to meet in the middle. Mr. Winicky. And in truth, I knew little about him. He reached across the table and poured a black substance he claimed was coffee from a stained old enamel pot and smiled. A flash of incredibly white dentures in the old brown leather face. "You're here about Gretchen," he said, the voice surprisingly strong, vibrant, almost young. "Everybody wants to know about Gretchen." I wasn't sure exactly what he was talking about and shrugged. "I don't know a Gretchen." "The dog," he said. "You want to know about the dog? Her name is Gretchen." "Ah," I nodded. "Yes, I want to know about Gretchen." "I knew you would come, the moment we met. Your eyes have dog in them." I did not know what he meant then. I do now, as I have learned to know now. But I knew when I met him that he had some large knowledge about dogs and other animals, and maybe about life, that I wanted to understand. I remember when I met him. It had been at a Christmas party. Some family with an immense house, one floor, 34 or 35 rooms around a Spanish-style courtyard, had invited soldiers from Fort Bliss to come for a Christmas party and dinner. It was a nice gesture. And some of us who were particularly not military in our thinking and on the raw edge of an abyss of too much open military knowledge were glad of the chance to get away from Fort Bliss and get non-mess hall food. There had been some drinking, though not that much. But at that time in my life, I did not drink at all. And as that part of the party grew, I wandered off around the courtyard into some other rooms that were open. In one of them there came a sound like a crowd of people talking, screaming, and jabbering, and I went in to see what was going on. It was a strange, rather small room with large potted plants, some of them floor to ceiling. I'd started to turn and leave when I heard the sound again. It was muted, as though far off, but it sounded like a large crowd, the kind you see on the street in a political rally or a car race. But it was inside the room. And curious, I stepped back inside and closed the door, or tried to close it. I felt a body come against it, and when it opened again, an old man entered. He had gone beyond where I, being just 18, could measure age. Deep-set wrinkles, bright blue eyes that, and I know it's cliché, twinkled, bald, with an impossibly white denture-flash smile. "Oh," I said, "excuse me."
"No problem."
He moved past me.
"I heard Betty. He's about to start the speech segment of his performance, and I like to hear him speak."
Betty, I thought, and him speak. Well, I decided, he's obviously old. I had an uncle in Minnesota who would have conversations with himself, start to finish, and maybe this old gentleman.
"I'm sorry," he said. "You haven't been here before, have you?"
"No, sir." There was something about him that made you want to call him sir. Some firm but gentle dignity.
"So you haven't got a single idea what I'm talking about, do you?"
"No, sir."
"Come here."
He moved to a back corner, beneath what looked like a kind of rubber plant, and pointed out a birdcage, which I hadn't seen before. It was a large cage, perhaps 4 feet high, and inside was a strange-looking bird, black, as big as a small crow, but with stripes of color on its side.
"This is Betty," he said. "He's a minor bird. Oh, and I'm Winnicky. Here's my card."
He handed me a plain card on which it said simply, "George Winnicky, trainer," with an address out near the border in Zaragoza. I put the card in my pocket and pointed to the bird. "I don't understand."
"Oh, he heard the crowd out there, the Christmas guests, and it triggers him to answer with his version of a crowd scene."
"That was her? Him? That whole muffled crowd sound?" He nodded.
"Traffic noise and all. It's the only crowd scene he knows, so he uses it to answer whenever he hears a crowd. You know, to get somebody in here to pay attention to him."
He turned to the bird.
"Hello, Betty. You're a pretty bird." "I know," the bird said. "Betty is a pretty bird. So pretty."
Then he lapsed back into the crowd sounds. I could have sworn I was listening to a large crowd outside the house. Then he hesitated. The crowd seemed to quiet down, and the next thing I heard clearly was the voice of the president giving a speech.
"Seriously?"
I asked Mr. Winnicky.
"President Kennedy?" "Perfect, isn't it? Sounds just like him. He's giving a campaign speech at some factory. I've never figured out which one it was, but it sounds just like him, doesn't it?"
Questions, I thought. I have all these questions. What? I mean, how? Why do you call him Betty? I mean, if it's a boy, why does he have a girl's name?
Simple. When they got the bird, they didn't know which sex he was, and the people who gave them Betty said it was a girl named Betty. By the time they found out he was a male, it was too late. He already knew his name, answered to his name, so they kept it. But that is not the most complicated thing about Betty.
How is it, I mean, how can he make the sound of a crowd and the voice of the president?
Again, it's not so strange. He heard it on the radio or on television. Many birds can mimic sound. Parrots, crows, ravens. They make exact replicas of sounds they hear. And even that is not the most interesting thing about Betty. There is still one question left to ask, and it is the most important one.
What is it?
Why?
Why what?
Why does Betty want to communicate with us, with people? Why is he calling out?
He wants to have people come to him, I said. He wants people to be with him.
And again, why?
I thought of myself, of what had become of me, of how I was after I joined the army. I did not have a family, not really,
and the army seemed to be then a very strange place.
Because he's lonely?
Lord, Mr. Winnicky said, smiling a sigh. Do you suppose that's it? That's all it is? He's lonely?
Of course, I didn't know, would probably never know. If the experts were right, I would soon be dead, burned in intense white clouds hotter than the sun. Nuclear war, according to them, according to the press, was imminent. The missiles were in Cuba, ready to be fired.
Yahoo!
Perhaps you should come and meet Gretchen. Perhaps she can show us. And so, to Gretchen. Mr. Winnicky, I never called him by his first name, though it was on the card, I never seemed to remember it, lived in a house down along the Mexican border that seemed run down when I first saw it, as I parked in the track that could hardly be called a driveway. Two ruts in the sandy dirt that led to a small chain-link gate, which was closed. The house was clapboard, which was strange in this desert country, with faded white paint and a small second story. It was surrounded by a yard that was mostly composed of desert sand, powdered clay dirt, and brush plants on the border that had obviously been hand-planted, but were so old and withered that God only knew what they were originally. I could not see a leaf anywhere on the dry gray branches. I parked and let myself in the gate, and as I latched it behind me, I heard a screen door slam open and spring closed, and turned to see a metallic gray streak of a dog screaming toward me from the porch steps.
"It's Gretchen," Mr. Winnicky called from the porch. "Don't worry, she's friendly. Just do as she tells you."
A strange thing to say, I thought. How could she tell me anything? But I stopped, waited, and was surprised to see her slam to a bottom-dragging stop 3 feet in front of me, eyes bright on my eyes, tongue hanging to the side in a happy smile. She sat for just a moment, studying me, then raised her right forefoot in a handshaking gesture. I nodded, leaned down, and shook hands, whereupon she came around me, tucked into a perfect heel against my left leg, and gently push-nudged me up the porch steps to the screen door. She opened it with her paw and nose and escorted me into the house, where she, again working her shoulder against my left leg, guided me to one of three chairs at an old kitchen table. She gestured with her nose and a nudge for me to sit down. Mr. Winnicky sat at the other end, and I was surprised to see Gretchen climb into the third chair, positioned so she was slightly between us, sitting on the chair with one paw on the table. She sighed then, looked first at me, then at Mr. Winnicky, then to the stove. All without any signals or help or even a sound from Mr. Winnicky.
"Would you," he now said softly, returning Gretchen's look at the stove, "like a cup of coffee?"
Is that a request from her? I stopped, then nodded.
"Please, I would like a cup of coffee."
He stood, moved to the stove, where he took the pot and two cups, which he put on the table, one for me and one in front of Gretchen. He poured coffee in both of them, filled his own, which was already on the table, then added some cream and sugar from a bowl into his cup before he returned the pot to the stove and sat slowly at the other end of the table. Gretchen took a short lap of her coffee, surprisingly neat, then looked up at me and with a gentle paw pushed the sugar bowl over toward me. The coffee was profoundly black, almost tar, and so strong it seemed to jump at me from the cup. I took the sugar spoon from the bowl and put 4 spoonfuls in my cup, stirred it, smiled at Gretchen, and nodded.
"This is good."
She, and it can only be called this, returned my smile, seemed to nod with satisfaction, looked at Mr. Winnicky, then back to me, and back to him, back to me.
"She wants us," Mr. Winnicky said. And now he smiled self-consciously, or seemed to have a conversation. He didn't seem embarrassed so much as just reluctant to ask something that on the face of it seemed so singular and odd. "I see," I said. "A conversation. She wants us to have a conversation. If you're going to tell me that she talks..." "Well, the truth is, she does talk. Or rather, not really. But when she started to train me..."
"She trained you?"
I stared at him, then at Gretchen. "Dogs don't train people." He smiled, as I had read in some book, not unkindly, and nodded slowly. "I had that same thought when it happened. Dogs, I thought, don't train people. People train dogs. But think now. Think of the mina bird that night at the party. He was making a crowd sound and the presidential speech, remember? He was making the crowd sound for what reason?"
"To attract,"
I said.
"To attract attention."
He nodded.
"From whom?"
"From the people at the party. From us."
"From the people at the party."
Mr. Winnicky nodded, again smiling, dentures impossibly white. "Whom he had trained to come when he made the crowd sounds."
"But couldn't it be the other way? Couldn't the people have trained him to make crowd sounds so they would come?"
And I could see it then. See how it didn't work backward. How it could never work backward.
"We think, we all think, people think, man thinks he is superior, always superior. And in truth, it is the other way around, dead opposite. Have you ever been to Yellowstone Park? You know, on vacation with your family?"
I shook my head. "Boyhood on uncle's farms, in the Philippines for 2 years. Then with drunk, abusive parents back in Minnesota until I could run away to the army. To initial training with personal weapons, then more training, school upon technical weapons school when not reassigned, until finally, and the word was finally, the ultimate and all-consuming horror of nuclear warhead school. And the impending all-destructive war with Russia, when we would all... when every single living thing on the planet would be, no, I didn't have that kind of family, you know, where we took vacations." He paused a moment, studying me, then nodded.
"Well, if you had, you would have seen the bears working at getting into cars as they drove slowly by on the park highway, getting the food the people in the cars had for them."
"Had been trained," I said, nodding. "That the people in the cars had been trained to bring, to feed the bears. The cute bears, the cute wild bears that did what they had to do to train people to bring them food."
"Exactly," he said, nodding again.
He paused to take a sip of the tar-black coffee, then hand-rolled a cigarette from a small packet of tobacco and wheat straw papers, which he lit with a large wooden match scratched on the underside of the table. He drew deeply, coughed intensely. It was then that I first truly noticed he had a viciously fluid-sounding, persistent cough, and gestured to Gretchen. She had been watching the conversation, swiveling her head from one to the other as we spoke, much like watching a tennis match, and I had noticed that now and then, at odd intervals, her ears would perk up, and she would seem to almost nod.
"I noticed being trained by Gretchen early on with her, when I first trained her to simply sit."
Another drag, which used up the rest of the cigarette so rapidly the red-hot end of it burned back into his fingers.
Although, to be honest about it, I think it had been happening all along with other dogs, horses, and even chickens.
Chickens?
Well, he said, smiling, and it seemed impossible that his dentures could remain so flashing white with all the coffee and cigarettes he consumed. Maybe just one or two. And a rooster. He closed his eyes and fought a cough, then opened them, but did not look at me. Instead, he softened his gaze and passed his eyes over Gretchen, then out the window, out and out, not looking at anything in particular, except perhaps a far time and place that didn't exist any longer.
"I've been training animals for a long time," he said at length. 50, 60 years. Dogs for hunting, for working stock, for companions. Horses for work and show, or just to gentle them. Trained almost every kind of animal that walks or crawls, except cats. Not a way to train a cat. They got no give to them. All take. Even trained or half-trained a couple of snakes for a fat man who came through El Paso making a movie about snakes. And I knew in the end that they all, even the snakes, trained me as well. Think of it. When a rattler sets to buzzing, what's he doing? A kind of talking, a warning. He's training you, teaching you to get away.
He reached now and ran one of Gretchen's soft ears through his gnarled, bent fingers, like silk through barbed wire. And I never saw it until I started with Gretchen. Got her to sit one day. The same day, she looked a long time at me and at a piece of cookie. And here she perked up, ears more alert with the word cookie, in my hand. And she saw the cookie and my eyes, and then she sat, clean and down, as much as if she'd said, "I'll sit, and then you give me that piece of cookie." And she did, and I did. And it was the first time I knew I had been wrong all along. I never trained one animal. Not once.
They trained you.
He nodded. I always got what I wanted, what I needed, or almost always. But it was all working backward, and I didn't know it, didn't see it, until Gretchen showed me how to see, how to know, how to learn.
Gretchen sat looking at him, into his eyes, as he talked, clearly loving him, but more, too, something more. She heard more, felt more in some way, and I realized with a start that she was listening to every word, every single word. And more, much more. She understood some of them. He had seen my look, and his smile widened, and he nodded.
That's why she wants a conversation. When she hears a word she knows, she feels like she's more a part of it.
How many does she know?
I'm not sure. I tried keeping track of them at first and got up to 700 or 750 before I lost the thread of it. I think she's way past 1,000 now. 1,000 words she recognizes and places with some object or place or thought. And she's learning more all the time, just stacking them up. But there's more, too.
I looked at her, thought I was maybe seeing some kind of a freak. No, miracle. Some kind of miracle. What could be more than this?
She has learned how to understand people in some way that goes with the language, so that you can actually talk to her, or almost talk to her.
Watch her. Watch her reaction when you say something she knows and likes. Say the word C-O-O-K-I-E.
Cookie, I said. And there it was. She perked at the word and, I swear it, seemed to add to it, to almost nod. Winnicky saw it as well and smiled. She knows the word, of course, and that was the alerting part of it. But that second little bit was because she likes it, wants to eat one. He stood and went to the cabinet over the sink, took a vanilla cookie from a jar, and gave it to her. She ate it with two small, delicate bites, then nodded again, and with a half-grimace, added a toothy look. "She's smiling," Winnicky said. She picked it up from a little girl who came to visit, who kept smiling at her. "Now say something she won't like, wouldn't think of eating." "Gretchen," I said, "would you like some broccoli?" And here she shook her head in a negative manner, studying me the whole time. "Now another thing she might like to eat." "Steak," I said, "smothered in gravy." She alerted, nodded, then smiled, and he gave her a cookie. We went back and forth that way for a time. Pork chops and spinach, chicken and grapefruit, beef stroganoff and eggplant. And she was right, dead right, every time. She would shake her head in a negative way when she didn't like it, nod in a positive way when she did. "She knows," I said, taking a sip of my coffee, somehow cold, it was more palatable than it had been hot. Cold and sticky sweet, like Kool-Aid from the devil. "She knows all the words. How is that? Is that even possible?" He shook his head. "It's not that. I doubt even all humans would know all the words. It's the other thing, the thing that surprised me and led me away from my former life, what I thought I knew my whole life." "What was that?" "She reads people." "I don't know what that means." "I'm not sure I do either. But I think she can tell by voice or posture or smell or some thought wave or something when a person is saying a food she wouldn't want to eat, or when he says something she would like. But how could she know me? We've never met. How could she know anything about me, about my speech or posture or smell? How could she know anything about me?" He nodded. "I understand and agree with your thinking, or how I believe you're thinking. But the thing is, it's not just you. I've had other people in here. Old people, young people, children barely old enough to understand what I mean, and they're all the same. She reads them all." "She's reading their minds?" I shook my head. "You think she's actually reading their minds?" He hesitated, sighed, rolled another cigarette, and poured more coffee, in my cup as well as in his, before I could stop him. I wouldn't be able to sleep for the rest of my life. "No." "Yes." "Maybe." "God, I don't know. But I have seen it, and know what I've seen. The only way I think I can understand it, or feel that I know what she's doing, is I have to think in some kind of way that I don't really believe in. Spirits and vapor clouds or thought beams or some of that other kind of wild stuff. Thing is, I'm just an old cowboy who took to training animals and don't know how that other kind of thing works. Do you?" I shook my head briefly, then thought of the school I was going to, with blast patterns and radioactive winds and radiation lobes and flash damage, with melted people who were turned into instantaneous shadows on concrete. He could not know any of this, would probably not understand it any better than I understood what I was seeing with Gretchen. "No, not really." "Is it?" he sighed. "Would it be something you might like to learn, to know?" I looked at Gretchen. She looked up at me, waiting, waiting. Waiting for what? For me? for me.
Yes, on the weekends when I'm not at school, I can come each weekend, if that's all right.
He nodded, and so it was that I came to talk to Gretchen and listen to Gretchen, and Gretchen kept me from going insane, or something like it. The thing was, I didn't know what I was seeing or hearing. I decided to take a notebook and simply write down words or subjects she liked or disliked and see if there was a pattern. Again, broccoli, head shake negative, steak, head moved in nod, turnip, negative, butter, positive, butter in negative tone, positive, spinach in positive tone, negative. Here, and almost in a regular rhythm, she would stop for a sip or a couple of laps of coffee, a tail wag, and, infrequently, the need to go outside and relieve herself, to return quickly, get back up in the chair to look at me quizzically, head cocked, waiting for the next question. No matter what I tried, I could not confuse her, catch her out. I changed tone of voice, facial expression, gesturing with hands, not gesturing with hands. Always she would give the correct, or what I assumed to be the correct answer. Pork chop, in angry tone, positive. Ice cream, in anger, positive. Vinegar, in loving tone, negative. I sat in the chair backward, watching her with a small mirror I found in an amazingly decrepit bathroom, and she never missed. Jackrabbit running fast, my back to Gretchen, positive. Bowl of okra, my back to Gretchen, positive voice, negative response with a small shake of the head and a courteous tail wag. Oatmeal, no condiment, negative tone, positive nod. Oatmeal, brown sugar, and butter on top. Negative tone. Positive nod. And slowly, over 3 or 4 or 5 weekends, it became evident that she was somehow reading me. And it was still more evident in another short time that she had begun testing me, seeing what I knew or could be taught. One cold November morning, at least cold for El Paso, I drove down along the river in my old 1951 Buick. Army pay then wasn't what it is now. I made $82.50 a month and was forced to pay 10% back in donations to United Fund that barely ran. I had paid $74 for the car, and it was worth that, or nearly. Inside, the old house was warm. A small pot-bellied stove in the corner burned a cherry red with mesquite, and Gretchen met me outside as she always did. Mr. Winnicky was gone, but he had left a pot of coffee. God, it was so strong. I still remember the bite of that first sip. It was worse even than army coffee, which was nearly brain-damaging. I sat at the table, jolted awake by the coffee, petted Gretchen on top of her domed head, got a tail wag, and in as positive a tone as possible said, "Used motor oil," and got no response at all. The first time. Clearly, it was something she wouldn't like to eat, and most of these decision questions involved food, or smell, or noise. And here, nothing. Then I noticed something. In front of her, on the table, was a small piece of prickly pear cactus, just a corner of a tiny lobe, big enough to have a couple of spines sticking out of it. I hadn't seen her bring it in, and for a moment I thought it must have stuck to her ear and flopped on the table. I reached to brush it off the table, and she stopped me with her nose, looked pointedly at the cactus, and gave a deliberate negative shake of her head, then looked up at me. "You don't like cactus?" I said. Again, a negative shake, then a focused study of my face, waiting. 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 For what? Me. A response. I looked at the cactus, saw the needle-sharp spines, and agreed wholeheartedly that I didn't like that piece of cactus either. I shook my head in a negative. Bang. She got rid of the cactus, put it by the door, and picked up a small stick. She put it on the table, looked up at me, and nodded, waiting. I returned the nod, reached for the stick, thinking she wanted me to throw it, but before I could pick it up, she grabbed it and was out the door. We were not to play. We were working, studying, thinking, learning. And so that day passed, not with me testing her, but the opposite. She was finding out what I knew, what I thought, and somewhere in that day, I realized with a kind of shock or stunned belief that we were actually talking. I had, as a small child, been raised by my grandmother, a wonderful, all-knowing woman, brought up on farms in Norway and later in northern Minnesota. She believed in the old Norse tales of gods and goddesses and spirits of another world, another spirit world that could and often did talk through animals, telling tales of love and hate and joy and music. Sometimes when birds were singing, she would put her hand on my arm and say, "Songs for you and me from them. The birds sing for them, for us." I did not disbelieve it, actually, but simply thought it was something perhaps only old people could know, a code I did not understand yet. Like when it was going to rain or snow, or when somebody would be close to death or birth. I was not skeptical so much as blank, unable to understand. But now it was true for me, and open, and clear. Gretchen was, in her way, a very real way, bringing me into a conversation. She knew many things I liked, and now she was showing me some of the things she liked and disliked. We were very definitely talking, and as the afternoon drew on, my level of astonishment grew lower, and I accepted it and began to understand what I was really doing. Having a conversation with a friend. We had, or rather Gretchen had, found a way to break down the communication barrier and interlock with another species. It was simple, clean, and very elegant. We looked at things, said what we thought of them, and with more depth than I thought possible, we understood each other completely. It was, in many ways, for me a life-saving understanding. I had come to the army as an escape from my life, as many men did, I suppose, and though I'd had a complex and rougher childhood than most, I was still virtually unsophisticated. I had seen many ugly things as a child in the Philippines, when the war with Japan was still not quite finished, and through the hazy viewfinder of alcoholic parents. But as the real world hit me, I was simply not able to handle it. Because I had a semi-technical background in high school, the Army started putting me through various electronic weapons schools. Missiles, both anti-aircraft and surface-to-surface tactical weapons, which included the care, maintenance, and firing of nuclear weapons, and so to nuclear warhead schools. At that time, and in many ways it is still true, the public was given at best a very limited and horribly skewed idea of what nuclear war would be like. True, we had dropped two nuclear weapons, designated then as atomic bombs, on Japan. One on a city called Hiroshima, and another on a city named Nagasaki. They were devastating and primarily leveled both cities. But little was told to the public then, except that a new kind of bomb had been used against the Japanese. Soon Russia also had the bomb, and the Cold War started. We rushed to the edge of nuclear war, and a kind of mass panic hit the United States, with people building bomb shelters and leaving to live in isolated parts of the world in sophisticated bunkers where they thought they might be safe. But little was told accurately about how the weapons actually worked, and much that was said was so wrong as to be dangerous and downright silly. In public schools, we were told to hide under our desks, or duck on the lawn and cover ourselves with our jackets, or hide along a wall with our hands over our heads. It was so incorrect, so inane, as to be criminal. And when the Army sent me to nuclear warhead school, I had absolutely no idea of what to expect, of the reality of this new kind of tech war. I was brought to a shattering of my ignorance almost as brutal as the weapons themselves. We sat at desks with notebooks the first day of the class. While most of the classes we took were taught by soldiers and sometimes ex-soldiers who were tech reps, in this case, a civilian walked into the room. He sat on the edge of a desk, lit a cigarette — we were ourselves not allowed to smoke except in outside breaks — smiled in an almost deprecating way, and said, "When the atomic bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, it killed between 85,000 and 120,000 people in 3/100 of a second. The human brain operates on a much slower frequency than that speed, and so therefore they were vaporized, reduced to less than their base molecular or carbon level, faster than they could think about it, faster than they could know. They would have had no cognizance of their own death, would simply not mentally know they had been killed, had died, or had ever lived. Nothing into nothingness." He took a drag off the cigarette. "The yield of that warhead was the same as approximately 20,000 tons of conventional explosive, and essentially the same for the warhead dropped on Nagasaki, with the same results. It is important for you to know now that in current terms, these are actually incredibly small warheads, and indeed are primarily used as triggers for larger yield weapons, weapons with millions of tons of yield, numbers that are almost literally unimaginable." But I was gone, stuck on the fact that hundreds of thousands, even millions of people with the more advanced weapons, could be killed without knowing it, could simply be evaporated into nothingness without knowing that it had happened. Was it then, I thought, like they had never existed at all, in their own minds, simply never have been? It was then, half a century ago, illegal to speak to anyone about any of this, so I bottled it up. But I could not stop thinking of it, the horror of it, knowing what practically nobody else could know. I was 18 years old and stuck with such insane knowledge. And then I met Gretchen, and so to sanity. I could speak to nobody else, no human, and so I spoke to Gretchen. On weekends, when Mr. Winnicky was not there, I would sit and have coffee with her. I must confess that I made it somewhat weaker than he would have done, and that she was often negative about how I made it, lapping a bit and then shaking her head slowly from side to side. But she was too courteous to be outright rude, and accepted my effort. The talks went on for 3 or 4 weekends, with me discussing various nuclear yields and how the bombs worked, and frankly, how insane it all was. And she was so kind to me. I mean, she was very negative about the whole thing, shaking her head from side to side. She did not approve of the use of nuclear tactical weapons at all. But in some way, she was gentle with me at the same time. We became closer and closer, and when she could sense my sincere frustration growing to an uncomfortable level, she would pause and go outside and bring me something positive from her own life, a favorite stick, a stuffed or rubber toy, which she would place on the table in front of me, pushing it slowly to me with her paw, an easing thing, a gentling touch. I had many dogs before knowing her, and Lord knows how many dogs have wonderfully entered my life in the past 50 years since I met her. But the way she helped me, as no human really could have helped me, by breaking down the interspecies interlock and letting her mind come into my thinking. There was such care, such love. Soon after this, I was sent once more to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, for still more missile and radar schooling. I was gone, without seeing her, for 7 months. When I came back, Mr. Winicky, doubtless due to the coffee, had passed away. When I went to see him and Gretchen, the house was empty, and the neighbor lady told me that when he died, Gretchen had come to her house and all but dragged her back for help, but it was too late. Soon after, his family had come and taken her back to the Houston area, where they lived. I wrote to them. This was half a century before the internet or email, and they informed me that not long after she had come to live with them, their 3-year-old daughter had nearly stepped on a diamondback rattlesnake in the backyard, but Gretchen had thrown herself between the snake and the little girl and had taken the strike on her shoulder. It had been a large snake, as many of the rattlers in eastern Texas seem to be, and a solid, direct strike. Such a bite would often have enough venom to be fatal. But the family found a vet with anti-venom serum. It was new at the time, and apparently they had all the neighbors and all the police calling all the people they could to locate the serum. And Gretchen, after a few days of scaring everybody, made a full recovery. I never saw her again, though I wrote now and then to the people who lived with her. I have never forgotten her, nor will I, and I think she had a full and wonderful life. I often think of her and see her sitting at that old kitchen table with the oilcloth cover and thick, thick black coffee in a stained cup, which she loved. And I smile when I think of what she would do if I made my voice as positive as possible and said softly, "Snake." A soft, negative movement, left to right, and then her paw pushing something positive, like the small red ball she loved so much, across the table to me. Chapter 3. Hollywood and the Woman Dog Who Knew Hemingway. Then 400 Sheep and Floating Louise, and the coyote that made Louise hate me. My life turned to Hollywood, oddly enough, and it proved a strange place to live, and a surprising place to run into an animal that could and did change my life. And yet, I came to Hollywood from the North Woods by way of having been a farm worker and a soldier and working in aerospace as a field engineer, none of which prepared me for what could only be called the madness of the natural workaday world of Hollywood. Consider. I went from helping to design and track satellites with huge dish antenna at a take-home pay of $500 a week to proofreading, the only job I could get, articles in so-called men's magazines on what kind of car you could drive that would help to favorably impress the ladies, along with articles on what kind of clothes to wear, what kind of hair color to use, what kind of toothpaste to brush with, what kind of cigarette lighter to use, what kind of food to order in restaurants, what films to see, what films to talk about, how to talk about them. The whole James Bond craze was starting then. When to talk about them, and why to talk about them. For $280 a month. It's what I thought I had to do to learn to write, or at least to make a start. So I found a tiny apartment for $200 a month, which left $80 a month for food, water, air, and any and all other necessities, and went to work. I read god-awful, horribly misspelled articles. This was long before computers or spell checkers came onto the scene, until my eyes nearly bled, while trying to learn to write at night with the help of 3 editors. "Start," said Dick Ashby, a wonderful old editor who worked slowly with me, "with a simple declarative sentence. Then do another, and another. Soon you have a book." It was something close to a living nightmare. I swear I had roaches that I had to ask permission from to use the bathroom and or the kitchen. And to add to the misery, they were my only company. A month went by, then another dragging, roach-filled